From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On April 2nd, in response to a series of deadly Palestinian attacks, the Israeli army invaded the West Bank town of Jenin in search of terrorists. 23 Israeli soldiers died in heavy street fighting there, as did a substantial number of Palestinians. The actual number of Palestinian dead, however, was unclear for weeks. A spokesman for the Palestinian Authority claimed the figure to be in the thousands. Soon there were reports of mass graves and the stench of decomposing flesh, and people began speaking of the Jenin massacre.
2 months later, it is clear there was no such massacre. The number of Palestinians who died in the Israeli operation was at most 56 in separate firefights. But throughout the world, the unskeptical reports of a massacre and of Israeli war crimes were commonplace. American news organizations were generally circumspect and cautious, but according to UPI senior news analyst Martin Seif, the Europeans were particularly careless. According to Seif, the restrictions on press access to Jenin led the media down a dangerously speculative path.
The widespread assumption that media people had was that the Israelis were keeping them out because they had something to hide. But there was another level to this as well. You find that Israeli officials in the first weeks of April are very cautious in their response about this themselves, because they hear the Palestinian claims, they know heavy fighting is going on in Jenin, and they themselves do not know how many people have died.
Now, there was another complicating factor in that while the press couldn't get into Jenin because the Israelis had closed it off, there were a couple of apparently neutral sources, the human rights organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and the United Nations itself, all of which were speculating about widespread death and destruction. To what extent did the press depend on these outside reports to rush to judgment?
These people played a very significant role in this. And one of the lessons we should learn, and the media on both sides of the Atlantic should learn from this experience, is you cannot trust blindly. I don't say not trust at all, but you cannot trust without independent verification what organizations like even Amnesty and the UN come out with. Here, the human rights organizations, which have been too slow to blow the whistle in other situations, blew it too fast.
You talked about the Atlantic Ocean. Let's talk about that for a moment, because I'd like to understand its calming influence. Why is it that the lack of information resulted in one kind of reporting in the European press, and 3,000 miles away in the United States, the press was far more restrained, far more responsible, and far less inclined to believe accusations of a massacre?
In the European print media, you have lots of different competing newspapers in Britain, Germany, Italy, France, and other countries, which have very clear ideological positions. The concept is the truth will emerge in a free market and through open debate. If you have a left-wing paper reporting from one area, you know there are right-wing papers which will look to expose the holes in the reporting, and vice versa. In many respects, this makes for complex and rich and nuanced reporting in general. But there is a profound underlying aspect to it, and that is that reporters, whether of right or left, tend to see themselves as ideological crusaders first. By contrast, in the United States, you have single large newspapers of record, like the LA Times, obviously, New York Times, Boston Globe, Washington Post, and the dominant theme in the American media is keep your cool, get the facts first, don't get carried away with ideological crusading.
Is there an undercurrent of anti-Semitism in the reporting among these major European newspapers?
In some cases, yes, definitely. You have The Columnist, who was not a reporter at Jenin, but a London columnist, A.N. Wilson, very respected literary figure in the Evening Standard, accuses the Israelis of poisoning the water of the Palestinians. Now, there is no evidence this occurred, not the slightest, but it has very disturbing echoes of one of the accusations which was used as an excuse to slaughter Jews for hundreds of years in the Middle Ages, that the Jews are demonic figures and cowardly figures who poison water.
Is there any evidence that the European press has been abashed by this situation, that they've learned their lesson and will, in the future, try to behave more responsibly and to moderate whatever ideology may be the underpinning for what turned out to be dangerously irresponsible reporting?
I think the honest answer to that, and as accurately as we can get, is yes and no. Yes, there are papers like Le Monde in Paris, the Daily Telegraph in London, Il Folio in Rome, and what is to me a very important example, an admirable example, the London Guardian, which did something which is extremely impressive and extremely morally courageous, in my opinion.
That's the Guardian in the United Kingdom made
precisely
the extraordinary move of apologizing for its errors.
For people who don't know, it's the main left of centre quality newspaper in Britain. And I think they came out of this as a result, certainly without a loss of honour and basically without a loss of credibility. But at the same time, as people have also pointed out, there seems to be no example of any reporter being reassigned because of this. Nobody has been disciplined. I doubt a single career will come under a cloud. And I'm not looking for people to be fired. I mean, I think people in glass houses should not throw stones, and all of us in the media know how difficult and challenging it is. But at the same time, it's important to have some standards there. And when you have here claims of massacres or hundreds of bodies being buried, and it turns out there is only one individual young Palestinian being cited as a source for this story, not just in one newspaper, but in three or four newspapers in Britain and half a dozen other newspapers in Western Europe, and that there is no independent corroboration of this except this one source, that's inexcusable. In situations like this where the harm can be so great, there has to be some accountability.
All right. Well, Martin Seif, thank you very much.
Bob, thank you.
Martin Seif is the senior news analyst for United Press International. Citizens of Afghanistan have gotten used to ignoring their local media. Afghans had good reason to be wary of a press forced to report what the government wanted it to report during 5 years of Taliban rule. But now that an interim government under Hamid Karzai has reintroduced press freedom, the country has been flooded with newspapers and magazines reporting on just about anything they want to. Still, for the Afghan public, old habits die hard. There's been no rush to take a look at these new publications. Joining us now is Indira Lakshmanan, who's been in Afghanistan reporting for the Boston Globe. Indira, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much for having me.
Just how much new media has popped up in Afghanistan recently?
Well, the change is really dramatic. There are more than 80 publications that have applied to the government for permission to operate.
Now, when you say 80 publications, are you talking about daily and weekly newspapers? Are you talking about specialty publications? You know, are we talking about Kabul Outlaw Biker? What kind of publications are these?
I don't think the Harley Davidson magazine has quite made it yet. The only daily publication available is a government-sponsored publication, because basically nobody else can afford to put out a daily newspaper. So the independent publications we're talking about are publications like Kabul Weekly. It's a pretty spunky publication that under the Mujahideen had been censured twice. So they've been reborn. So has Malalai, a brand new publication, which is a women's monthly magazine. There's also a satirical magazine, Zambe Gilam, you know, satirical cartoons and comical depictions of themselves. So there's a huge variety of publications.
Well, let me ask you maybe an obvious question. We're talking about a country where the illiteracy rate is estimated at 80%. Who's going to read this stuff?
Well, you make a very good point. I mean, to some extent, I suppose it's journalists publishing it for government ministers who read it, NGOs, non-government organizations, UN agencies. I mean, those are the kinds of people who have subscriptions. But it's also important to remember that almost in any village or community, there is at least one person who can read, whether it's the local teacher or the local mailman, there's at least someone who can read the paper. And what they do is every morning they'll sit down and read the newspaper aloud, and other people will crowd around them and listen to the news. So in that sense, it is a community activity, and the news does get distributed even if there's only one person who can read it.
Well, how about ordinary Afghans, and especially illiterate Afghans? Where do they turn for news? I would say radio and television, but I guess there aren't a whole lot of televisions in Afghanistan.
Exactly.
Either.
Exactly. So. You're quite right. They absolutely turn to the radio. That is the major source of news. Now people are getting a very innovative program called Good Morning Afghanistan. The way that this program has really gained an audience is by focusing on sort of bread and butter everyday issues, like why are the roads not paved? Why is there not good electricity source? And of all of the new media, they're the ones who probably made the most difference because they've been able to get government ministers onto their program and really interrogate them. And actually, after the Minister for Public Works was interviewed, there was suddenly a great increase in the number of potholes and roads that were being fixed in Kabul, at least. So it seemed to have had some effect.
After such a dramatic change in government and culture in such a short period of time, one of the things that has changed is that the censorship that characterized the Taliban regime has been almost entirely lifted. But governments, by their nature, are nervous about the media. And journalists, by their nature, don't like any kind of obstacles in the way of reporting the news. Are journalists complaining yet about having to deal with a heavy-handed Karzai government?
There was a rather high-profile incident in March when there was a joint press conference held between President Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan and Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan. And there was only one Afghan journalist who was called upon during the conference. It was someone from Kabul TV. And he tried to ask a question about the border dispute between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And before he could even finish saying the question, Hamid Karzai said, "This is not the right time for that question. Sit down." And afterwards, there was a huge gripe session going on among the members of the Afghan media who were there who said, first, they weren't even going to let us into the press conference. Then we finally got in, and they weren't going to let us ask a question. And then one of us finally got to ask a question, and we didn't even get to finish asking it. So they were quite bitter about it.
So is there a double standard where there's window dressing for the Western media and a different, more repressive standard for the domestic media?
Well, I'm not sure whether it's fair to say that. I mean, I interviewed the Minister of Information about this very incident. And he said, "Well, you don't understand. This was a reporter from Kabul TV, which is state-owned television. And how would you like it if the State Department employee got up and asked a really embarrassing question when President Bush was having a press conference with some other nation?" I said to him, "Well, I don't think it's exactly a parallel situation." His response to me was, "Well, we can't have all the change in the world overnight."
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Indira Lakshmanan is the Asian Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. She's based in Hong Kong.
Coming up, the way the media can manhandle an image. We consider the FBI and the New York Mets.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, FBI Director Robert Mueller announced that the Bureau would undergo a major overhaul. Longstanding doubts sparked by such PR debacles as Ruby Ridge, Richard Jewell, Waco, and Wenho Lee have given way to even deeper concerns that FBI incompetence made it easier for terrorists to reach their targets on 9/11. Mueller suggested this week that the problems stemmed not only from a lack of manpower, but from an insular and paranoid agency culture. As stories in Time and The New Yorker noted this week, information is not shared and often not acted upon, careerism and fear rule, and the initiative of individual agents is squelched by bureaucrats. Those traits clearly derive from the Bureau's most famous exponent, J. Edgar Hoover. But one characteristic the Bureau did not inherit from its most infamous boss was his penchant for media management.
But I'd like to be a G-man and go bang, 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 bang. I'd be a brave gangbusting he-man and go bang, 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 bang. I'd put on disguises of all different sizes, and would I win prizes for telling who spies is?
I'll tell you, things have really changed.
Ronald Kessler is author of Inside the FBI, the world's most powerful law enforcement agency.
Under Hoover, the Bureau created this image of this invincible agency where they always got their man. They did this through the media, through radio shows, TV shows, movies that they controlled.
Many of the incidents in the story you are about to hear are based on the actual records and authentic experiences of Matt Savetic, who for 9 fantastic years lived as a communist for the FBI. Here is our star, Dana.
J. Edgar Hoover, the agency's public face, policed the agency's image through an office with the impenetrable name of the Crimes Records Division. It was charged with furnishing what were called interesting case memoranda to the radio shows and later the TV shows and movies over which Hoover exercised an invincible veto power. He was ever vigilant in pursuit of good PR.
I am your new director. I did not ask for the position, but now that I have it, I intend to give it the best I have. The Bureau will operate solely on efficiency, and we are going to do it as a team. Henceforth, it will be a we organization.
Once upon a time, Hollywood loved the organization.
David Edelstein is the film critic for Slate.com.
There was something very, very reassuring about the discipline, the order, the routine, the sticking to the rules. There was something very reassuring about those men in those gray suits, all with identical haircuts.
But the love affair had cooled for the average American round about 1975 with the Senate investigation of the FBI under Frank Church. Richard Powers is the author of G-Men, Hoover's FBI in American Popular Culture.
That pretty much blew the lid off all of the FBI horrors that Hoover had kept, you know, bottled up over all those years. The Church Committee delved particularly into the FBI's harassment of Martin Luther King Jr. And so as you had King emerging as one of the great heroes of American life in the 20th century, his great antagonist was J. Edgar Hoover.
Hoover always said justice would prevail, and it did. After the revelations of the Church Committee, Hoover's attempts to destroy King as a leader boomeranged.
Once you have an image that the FBI promoted during the 1930s of being an omnipotent, all-knowing, all-powerful agency that never could make a mistake, it was setting itself up for a terrible fall.
Already, the culture was tiring of the organization man. It was the end of a long battle Hoover had waged with Hollywood since 1935, when James Cagney played a renegade G-man. The agency hated the film, but grew to love it because it boosted the FBI's popularity like gangbusters. Author Richard Powers says that Americans always embraced characters that were square pegs and round holes, even as Hoover labored to shave the edges off.
And that's what successful adventure entertainment is all about. And it was completely contrary to the FBI image. And so they were really at loggerheads.
So the image of the FBI splintered. Films like the Die Hard series showed up the FBI as officious and obstructionist bureaucrats.
Al, talk to me. What's going on here?
That's the FBI. They got the universal terrorist playbook, and they're running it step by step.
Meanwhile, the Bureau regained a measure of its old omniscience with a Jodie Foster vehicle.
Yeah, Starling, tell me what you see.
Oh, he's a white male. Serial killers tend to hunt within their own ethnic groups. He's not a drifter. He's got his own house somewhere, not an apartment.
Why?
What he does with them takes privacy. And he's never impulsive. He'll never stop.
Why not?
Got a real taste for it now. He's getting better at his work.
Not bad, Starling.
Louis Starling and Silence of the Lambs probably did more for the Bureau as a fictional case than any real case, any real publicity that the Bureau could have done. It was amazing.
Ex-profiler John Douglas is the model for Agent Starling's mentor, Jack Crawford, played by Scott Glenn.
The character was very, very serious, and I always told the people working with me after we saw the movie, if I was that serious day in and day out, I'd be wearing a blue chiffon dress, smoking a cigar. I just wouldn't be able to keep up that intensity.
And just as Cagney's G-Man infuriated the Bureau for a while, so did Silence of the Lambs.
A lot of high-ups in the FBI itself at first didn't like the movie. They said it was very, very violent. And when I went to a movie screening, I got up and I said, I don't know what the rest of you think in the FBI, what kind of work we're doing here, but I see this work day in and day out. This violence does exist in our country.
But the higher-ups piped down when recruitment soared.
Damn, you know, who wouldn't want to sign up and go out and hunt themselves some serial killers?
Critic David Edelstein says that despite anecdotal evidence to the contrary, the gods of Tinseltown have consistently favored the Bureau with positive portrayals.
In the beginning, the FBI was all that stood between us freedom-loving Americans and those nasty immigrant gangsters. Then the FBI was all that stood between us and that evil communist menace. Then when the communist menace no longer seemed so imminent, suddenly the FBI was out doing battle with right-wing white supremacists and the Ku Klux Klan.
Even The X-Files, which depicts a dark and dangerous place, an agency at war with itself, has proved a boon to the FBI. As long as it seems powerful, the Bureau can't lose.
It's only in very, very, very rare instances that the FBI is portrayed as incompetent, which seems to me the worst danger to an organization that thrives on secrecy and that presents itself as a model of superhuman and enlightened efficiency.
A headline in Thursday's Financial Times dubbed the FBI America's most criticized. And according to a Time CNN poll, a majority of Americans believe that the FBI was very or somewhat responsible for the lack of governmental action to prevent the 9/11 attacks. That puts it on par roughly with the CIA, an agency that has always had a murkier reputation. Nevertheless, FBI recruitment is still robust, spurred partly by patriotism and, as always, by the entertainment media. There's a lesson in that. As director Robert Mueller sorts through the mess and reorders the agency's priorities, he may want to consider beefing up the Bureau in Hollywood.
They may not have come, but they have one way to go. Gangsters are dumb, for by now they ought to know. Did you up there or the gang you over there? Hoover will bring them to the electric chair.
D-D-E-F-T, G-Man, G-Man, Hoover.
Sports stars often have to deal with trade rumors, or these days, steroid rumors. But 2 weeks ago, Mets catcher Mike Piazza had to quash a rumor about his sexual preference. The gossip was becoming a distraction to the team, and Piazza put it to rest, or at least tried to, with the unequivocal statement, "I am a heterosexual." But at the newspaper where the gossip began, the New York Post, the furor was just beginning. Columnist Neil Travis started the rumor by twisting a quote, an unsourced quote, to suggest a famous Met player was about to announce he was gay. When the Post's sports columnist Wallace Matthews was asked by his editor for his take on the story, he wrote a column condemning Travis as a shoddy journalist. The Post delayed running this bit of self-criticism, and Wallace quit. The Post says he was fired for insubordination and for posting his column on the web without permission. His editors refused to join us on the show, but Wallace Matthews did not refuse. He joins us now. Wally, welcome to OTM.
Pleasure to be here, Bob.
All right, the Post says you were fired. You said you quit. Which is it?
I quit, and 8 hours later they fired me for the insubordination of having quit. I couldn't write my column without mentioning the Post's accountability, and when they objected to that, we came to our loggerheads, which ended with my employment ending there, let's say by mutual agreement, but I'm telling you, I quit at 10 in the morning. They fired me about 6 o'clock that night.
Okay, now hold on a second, Wally. Isn't it part of the package when you take your paycheck from the New York Post that there will be items in the paper that will infuriate you almost on a daily basis?
Absolutely, and it does happen. However, this is one that directly affected something that I was writing. And the way that I've been able to justify this, Bob, and I understand, you know, there are people out there who say, well, he took their money for 8 years. Yeah, I did. But for about the past 2 years, I've seen a perceptible shift in the tone of the paper and the accountability of the paper. And I have been able to justify this by saying, well, as long as my stuff lives up to my own standards and I don't indulge in that kind of thing, you know, I think I can separate myself from the rest of it. However, this particular story, the two things crossed over completely. I mean, when an editor asked me to write a column about Mike Piazza coming out and saying I'm not gay, I start pointing fingers. That's what I get paid to do. And the bone of contention between myself and my employer was that they didn't want Neil Travis or the Post criticized in print. I said, this is one of the reasons why the Post has such horrible credibility, because we make mistakes like this and we don't correct them, we don't apologize, we just laugh about it and move on. And I tell you the truth, I don't think my column works without mentioning Neil Travis's responsibility in all this.
Although, in fairness to the Post and in fairness to Carl Allen, the editor, he was prepared to run this piece, as it turns out, the next day. I know you weren't aware of that when you quit, but...
That was too late, and I'll explain to you why, Bob.
Okay.
You know, an editor has a certain duty to try to get his reporter's work into the paper the next day if it's been done under good faith and to professional standards, which mine was. And if you've read the column, I think you know that. Now, my request to Greg Gallo, my supervisor, and to Pat Hannigan, his deputy, was to take this column to Carl Allen on Tuesday night and get either thumbs up or thumbs down from him and to put us on the phone together so I could explain my position and he could explain his. This was never done by either of those gentlemen for whatever their reasons. But I told Greg Gallo that if you don't do this and this column doesn't run tomorrow, I will not write for you anymore. I cannot work with you if you will not go to bat for me on this. And when I picked up the paper Wednesday morning and I saw that he did not run the column on Wednesday morning, my decision had already been made. You know, I don't consider myself a hero, a victim, or a martyr here, but at least admire me for being a man who, when I say something, I stick to it.
Well, let's go back to the Post for a little bit.
God, must we?
Let's just say that this issue had not come up. Were you incrementally being disillusioned by the journalism practices there to the point that you might have found yourself quitting absent this precipitating event?
I don't think so, Bob, because they had just extended me a 2-year contract, which I had not signed only because some details had to be worked out. In fact, I had a talk with my boss about this because he knew that I was uncomfortable with many of the things that were done in the paper, and he asked me, you know, do you still feel comfortable working here? And I gave him the answer I just gave you. As long as I feel that my stuff is done to the best of my ability, I can overlook what happens in the front of the paper, but I cannot tell you that there weren't many days when I picked up the paper and I was embarrassed by it. Quite honestly, I mean, we had had disputes about criticism of the paper in my columns previously, but in all of those, the conflict was resolved, and I agreed to take the offensive passages out. This was one instance in which I felt the column could not stand without it.
All right. Well, listen, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Wallace Matthews is a former columnist for the New York Post. During our everlasting election cycle, there's a sort of Washington gavotte that is performed in front of us in major magazines and on the Sunday chat shows, where certain politicians are anointed as the next great presidential hopeful. The latest example of this is Democratic North Carolina Senator John Edwards.
Or so contends National Journal writer William Powers. He describes a multi-step process whereby potential candidates are discovered, celebrated, anointed, and sometimes squashed, only to rise again. In fact, he says, it's exactly how the Hollywood media treat aspiring starlets. Powers calls it the Hollywood-Washington paradigm. Welcome to OTM.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So let's get to this paradigm. What are those stages?
Well, I'll go through them quickly, Brooke. The first is this sort of getting-to-know-you stage where the politician, as a movie star would, makes scattered appearances in the magazines, People magazine, some of the TV shows, the Today Show, that kind of thing. And the second stage is what I call the run-up, which is where the person is the subject of a major profile, sort of a life story that preferably is quite moving and heartfelt. And that happened for John Edwards in the Washington Post. The third stage is what I call validation, where a magazine that is involved in sort of really crowning a person as the front runner or a superstar does the piece that says, here is the person you need to pay attention to. In this case, interestingly, Vanity Fair, which is the chief anointer of movie stars, also did the job on John Edwards with a Valentine that said, here's the next great Democrat.
And that Valentine was penned, of all people, by Christopher Hitchens, not known for writing love notes.
No, exactly. And that made it all the more noteworthy that Christopher Hitchens, this very tough Washington journalist, took a real shine to this politician.
And then comes the think piece.
Yes, inevitably, Brooke, you have this piece that sort of attempts to put a kind of a brainy cast to this craze and this person and explains that we care about this person for a reason that's larger than we had realized, which is there's some zeitgeist shift happening and they represent it. In this case, the New Yorker magazine, which is very good at doing those kinds of pieces, basically pointed out, here's a guy who's a personal injury lawyer who might run for president. And in fact, we're in an age of what you might call a courtroom-style politics of anecdote, where the nation might be ready for that kind of a candidate because we live in those times.
Now, the next stage is what you call the meta piece.
The meta piece is the piece where the journalist steps back and says, whoa, there's been a lot of kind of attention to this person. I'm going to be sort of two notches smarter than everybody else and write about the scene and the attention and try and make sense of that. So a movie journalist might go to Sundance and write about the whole crazy scene of movie makers trying to get famous at that festival. In this case, U.S. News, I pointed to a piece by Roger Simon in which he went to New Hampshire recently, followed Edwards around and sort of made fun of the scene around Edwards.
And then you come to what seems to be a bit precipitous, the flop.
Yes, you know, I had this great build-up for Edwards in the last few months, all these pieces appearing, much excitement. And then suddenly he did this interview on Tim Russert's Sunday show, Meet the Press, which is really the ultimate TV show now for a politician to be on in Washington. And he really was a disaster. It was just stunning how unremarkable he seemed.
Do you believe that Sharon should negotiate with Arafat?
I think that's a decision he needs to make. You know, he's, as I said, he has evidence he's going to talk to us about that he believes shows Arafat is complicit, has some responsibility for what's happened.
Well, Bill, I watched it too, and it struck me he wasn't remarkably unremarkable. He threw around the same boilerplate you see all politicians throwing around.
True. You know, we slice it pretty thin inside the Beltway, and I live inside the Beltway. But I felt that in reading some of these pieces we've described, I was expecting several cuts above the standard politician, and what I got, as you point out, was standard issue.
Which brings me to the whole premise of your article. Does this have anything to do really with the public, or is this purely an inside the Beltway phenomenon?
No, it doesn't matter outside the Beltway. It matters very little. But as in Hollywood, these insiders really kind of pull a lot of the levers that decide who's going to get that chance, you know, who's going to be in the final, you know, six or whatever contenders for the big slot. And so I think in that sense it does matter, and the more people beyond the Beltway are aware of it, the more intelligent they'll be about how we wind up with the guys we wind up with.
The one particular Hollywood star that you liken Edwards to is John Travolta, who had a big flop called Moment by Moment. It took him 15 years to crawl back to the top with Pulp Fiction. You really think that Edwards took that kind of a flying flop?
Yeah, I did want to point out my final stage in this paradigm that I've outlined is the comeback. And I think the cycle has become a lot tighter time-wise, both in movies and in politics. And so John Edwards had a flop very early. I think he could have a comeback, frankly, next week.
Bill Powers, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Bill Powers is a writer for the National Journal.
Coming up, why people who go to the bathroom during the commercials should go to jail.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When TiVos and Replay TV hit the market, some people were saying, you know, these machines could change TV as we know it. Because if you use these two devices, you never have to watch a commercial. While it's true that remote controls led to channel surfing and taping a program on a VCR lets you fast forward past ads, studies showed that TiVo and replay TV lead to commercial zapping, the likes of which the ad industry had never seen. But we haven't exactly seen runaway sales for TiVo and replay TV, so it was all a tempest in a TiVo, right? Well, wrong. The ad industry is quaking in its Gucci loafers because it collectively worries that in a couple of years, all TVs will be sold with TiVo technology, and then look out, or more precisely, tune out, those ads. Michael Fremmer is senior contributing writer to Stereophile magazine and an expert in all things digital. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be back.
So, first of all, replay and TiVo, explain for us what they are, what they do.
Well, they're basically a digital video recorder, essentially. And because it's a hard drive-based product, it's kind of like your computer. You can get random access to anything on the disk. You can record and watch at the same time, and you can push pause and go get something to eat, come back, and push play while the show is being recorded, and you can watch in real time. You know what I'm saying? You don't have to wait till the show is finished and then rewind it and watch it. TiVo has certain other aspects of it, like it's got a searchable database where you can say, I want any show with Jim Nabors on in the next month. I want you to find and record for me, and it will do that. It's a search engine kind of based thing.
And by their nature, both of these devices enable viewers, if they wish to delay seeing advertising, to avoid seeing advertising altogether.
It's able to skip the commercials, and this is creating a big problem for the advertisers and for the networks, because they feel that if everybody gets one of these and they watch everything pre-recorded or with commercials skipping, then they will lose advertising revenue. I think they're a little bit hysterical at this point in time.
It's reasonable, though, for the broadcast media to be a little bit hysterical about this development, because what pays for the programming is the advertisers and their commercials. So if people stop watching commercials, maybe the advertisers will lose faith in the commercial broadcast model and go other places to try to figure out how to persuade consumers.
I don't think that's really going to happen. And I know that they feel threatened, that their model is threatened, but apparently some network executive said that people who skip the commercials are stealing the television shows. This is so ludicrous.
Yeah, no, that was Jamie Kellner. He is the big boss at Turner Broadcasting.
That's hysterical.
Is it hysterical? Why is he wrong?
Well, calling the people who might want to skip commercials thieves doesn't help the situation, because it's an incendiary statement. But people have been recording shows, you know, since the VCR came out, which, don't forget, the film industry wanted to stop because they were afraid that their movies would be stolen and they'd lose a lot of money. What ended up happening was they made more money on the pre-recorded VCRs and DVDs than they ever dreamed they could make on what was in the movie theater. Now, the problem is they couldn't imagine, because the lawyers were driving this, they couldn't imagine how they might change their business model to make more money. So they fought it. And luckily for them, they lost. Why are they screaming and yelling hysterically about it now? For one very simple reason. It's now digital. And what has happened is the industry is of a mind, and this goes to the Fritz Holling bill that they're trying to pass, that because it is now digital, it's something that changes the whole working model of the thing. So when you skip over the commercial, it's more onerous. And I don't see why there is a distinction. Basically, they're using digital as a red herring to try to gain control of what they're trying to let us watch and listen to.
Walt Disney Company, which owns ABC,
which was the prime mover in trying to stop VCR, don't forget.
They want to go to the manufacturers of the replay device and go into consumer data and find out who among the customers have been avoiding commercials, and then charge a fee for the lost opportunity to Disney of those eyeballs that their advertising clients have paid for.
The outrageousness of that on its face should be quite obvious. It's none of the business what I'm looking at and what I'm watching.
Last week there was a controversy in Britain because the BBC has cunningly figured out a way to find the other edge of the double-edged sword that is these TiVo devices. What they did was send programming that the individual TiVo owners hadn't pre-selected, and it sat there for 1 week. People couldn't erase it. Has that happened in the United States, as far as you know?
I don't know. I haven't heard about it. But I would say if they want to do something like that and they said to you, because TiVo is, you pay a fee per month. If they would say, we'll cut your fee in half, or we'll cut your fee by $2 if you're willing to have us dump a couple of shows on your hard drive, an hour's worth a week or 2 hours worth a week, I think people might say, okay, fine. you know, what do you want to send me? I mean, there's all kinds of changes that could be made. That's the whole brilliance of what's happening with digitization, is that everything changes. You can't stop the change. You can simply adjust to it.
Well, Michael, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Michael Fremmer is a senior contributing writer for Stereophile magazine.
And here's another quote from Turner Broadcasting's Jamie Kellner in Cable World magazine last month. He writes, "The free television that we've enjoyed for so many years is based on us watching commercials. But there's no Santa Claus. If you don't watch the commercials, someone's going to pay for television, and it's going to be you." We asked Kellner to come on the show. He said no, adding that he was concerned that the public was hearing comments he had intended for industry ears only. And his message to the ad industry, we need a new business model, and we need it fast. Scott Donatin is the editor of Advertising Age and has been pondering the options available to ad agencies in the era of the zappable commercial. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So commercials have always been zappable, or I think the current expression now is zippable. What really is the big change here?
Well, there's always been something of a leap of faith, or at least a feeling that if you're watching TV, for example, and you zap a commercial now, in other words, you change the channel, that you're watching something else then. You're watching another program or you're watching another commercial, and that somehow it all comes out right in the end. And I'll admit that that's always been something of a squishy science. But what we're really talking about here are digital technologies that really allow you to just eliminate the advertising completely. And the answer that a lot of advertisers seem to be coming up with right now is, if they're not going to watch the ads, then I have to figure out a way to integrate my marketing messages into the program itself.
Product placement. Well, that's a very old tactic. It dates back to the beginning of television. Have they updated it, or is this just old wine in its original bottle?
They've updated the language. They call it product integration now instead of product placement. But really what's ironic here is that you have on the one hand one of the most advanced technological changes ever that really switches around the whole television model. And on the other hand, the most creative answer that the ad industry has come up with so far is, hey, let's go back to what we were doing in 1950.
Well, we've read in the New York Times that NBC's version of The View, called The Other Half, has male hosts with guests from Clorox and Hyundai, and we've heard that Rosie O'Donnell ate a Wendy's salad on her show. Where else is this stuff showing up?
It's starting to show up in reality programs. Survivor did a lot of this with Target and some other advertisers. In some cases, the advertiser's product would become the reward that the survivors got if they completed a certain task. And we're also beginning to see it inside of scripted programming. Will and Grace did something with Xbox and Microsoft. Even a couple of years ago, CBS did something to promote Elizabeth Taylor's perfumes by building a search for the black diamonds into their various TV shows. So it's really starting to spread to films as well.
Excuse me, I'm just going to take a delicious sip of Mountain Dew.
Enjoy.
Now, in a recent column in Ad Age, you wrote, product integration deals are clunky and unnatural. They will surely be rejected by consumers who will no longer trust the advertiser or network that presents them with such transparent dreck. And then you put in parentheses, this may be wishful thinking. The success of televised celebrity boxing matches proves millions of people enjoy transparent dreck. So which is it? Will we buy it or won't we?
I really still have some faith in the viewer. I think that this basically is a perversion of what the media model has always been, which is you created great content that was either an entertaining program or an informative program, and then advertisers basically leveraged that relationship that the program had built with the audience. Here what you have is people beginning to talk about developing scripts and programs first and foremost around the goal of selling the advertiser's product, and with a secondary goal maybe of entertaining or informing the audience. And I've got to believe when you really start to have this being, you know, one of every five shows we're watching and then one of every four shows we're watching, I think people are going to get fed up with that pretty quickly. The other thing is I think a lot of these programs that try to start with the advertiser in mind first are just going to be awful. We saw it with Coca-Cola did something two summers ago called Young Americans, and Coke was so over the top in the product placement. Every time something happy was going to happen in any character's life, they grabbed an ice-cold Coca-Cola. And what happened was the show bombed.
So what happens if advertisers ultimately lose faith that putting ads on television is effective? What happens to television, and where does that ad money go?
it's almost impossible to think about, actually, because right now most advertisers still spend 70 or 80 cents out of every ad dollar on television. It's seen as by far the most effective medium to advertise to large groups of people. So it would really change all of mass marketing as we know it. It would radically transform it. And the answer is there's no place else for that money to go. There's places for some of it to go. You could say that more money would be spent on internet advertising or in magazines. But if, in fact, television was ever to not be a viable advertising medium, and I don't think we'll actually reach that day, but if we did, it would ultimately really transform in a radical, downsized way the advertising business as we now know it.
All this from a TiVo.
All this from a TiVo.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Scott Donaton is the editor of Advertising Age. For moviegoers weary of Jedis and spiders, the most popular film last week was Insomnia, in which Al Pacino plays a cop who wrestles with his own demons and plants evidence. It's reminiscent not only of Denzel Washington's Academy Award-winning portrayal of a dirty cop in Training Day, but of countless other corrupt cops portrayed in films going all the way back to Orson Welles' Touch of Evil and before.
I saw that shoebox 10 minutes ago,
Captain. Yeah, well, maybe you didn't notice.
I knocked it over on the bathroom floor. I couldn't very well have failed to notice two sticks of dynamite.
Tell any story you want.
The shoebox was empty.
Go on saying it's empty. Folks will understand.
I'm saying more than that, Captain. You framed that boy.
Framed him!
More recent depictions of the dirty cop can be found in L.A. Confidential, Gang Related, Copland, Exit Wounds, Internal Affairs. David Milch is one of the creators of ABC's long-running NYPD Blue and a writer on such police dramas as Brooklyn South and Murder One. He says society likes to see cops in black and white, bad and good. But the reality, the one he tries to portray, is that the good cop is the one who breaks the rules because he has to. David Milch, the cops you write break the rules all the time.
Yeah.
Why?
Because that's the nature of their job. Anytime you see a police show and the first thing a cop says when he brings someone into custody is, you have a right to remain silent, turn off the show. It's a joke. At that moment, you have come to a fork in the road because the Miranda law says you have to tell a guy you have the right to remain silent. No cop says that because his job is to keep a suspect separate from his lawyer. What society wants him to do is get the confession and then lie or indulge society's need to maintain the illusion that the constitutional niceties were observed. And you see now in the aftermath of 9/11 the surfacing of what has been latent in the social contract with cops right along, which is take them all in, round them all up, keep them in preventive detention. Yes, we want the Constitution observed, but if it's a question of our safety or the observation of the Constitution, say goodbye to the Constitution.
Do you think that your personal attitude toward bending the rules filters through your writing? And if so, do you feel responsible for how the public perceives the cops because of the characters you write?
I don't think I've written too many cops who have not enhanced the public's understanding of what it means to be a cop, the personal price that a cop pays. You know, because when you live outside the law, which we force cops to do, you pay an enormous emotional price. The violence that we identify in them is a violence of spirit. It's a willingness to go outside the law. You know, that's where criminals live. And so that's where cops go.
But isn't it a very short distance from living where criminals live and becoming a criminal yourself? You know, that's what happens in Denzel Washington's character in Training Day.
That is not a $2 cab ride, the little trip you just took. What happens to Denzel Washington's character in Training Day is an extravagance. Very, very few cops wind up that way.
What about the prevalence of bad cop depictions in the movies? Where do you think that comes from?
defects of imagination. That's where all bad writing comes from.
I'm not talking about bad writing. I'm talking about very good writing about bad cops in such films as, say, L.A. Confidential and more recently Training Day.
Well, you and I have
Day.
A disagreement about that.
All right. Well, are you saying then that any depiction of a bad cop is solely bad writing?
No, there are purely bad cops. You know, I can write those characters, but they don't interest me particularly because they're purely bad people, and to focus on the fact that they're cops is to distort their essence.
What media depictions of cops most affected you when you were growing up? It wasn't Joe Friday.
No. I kind of like Naked City.
What about movie depictions? What did you think of Serpico?
I enjoyed watching it. I didn't think it had much to do with cops. But
it was based on reality.
No. No, it wasn't.
You beg to differ.
I beg to differ. I mean, I know something about the real Serpico, and that was not Al Pacino.
All the films that we've discussed were before 9/11. What do you see happening after?
I think there'll be creative jingoism. I think that now you'll see an idealization of law enforcement and of the military, which is just as hypocritical, just as distorting, and ultimately just as destructive to the public's understanding.
You know, we often hear about cops complaining about the media, especially the news media. Do cops complain about the way they're depicted in entertainment media?
Yeah, they do. But the complaint does not have to do with the fact that bad cops are shown. Every cop knows that there are bad cops. But so much of entertainment that has to do with cops grows out of the signing on by the writer to a social hypocrisy about what it is that cops really are and the job that we want them to do. And an awful lot of entertainment comes from that superficial reaction to having to see violence. People don't want to be forced to address the consequences of the things that cops have to do to keep them safe.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much.
God forbid you ask yourself, did he only go because he was getting hit?
That's an absolute accurate concern.
So how do you deal with that?
If I feel I gotta do it, I hit him.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Kathy Rogers with Sean Landis and Michael Cavanaugh, engineered by Scott Strickland, Dylan Keefe, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Andy Lanton and Eric Wellman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. You want my shield? Here, take it. Take it.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.